Like some huge, many-limbed animal, the regiment began to prepare its lair and its food. One part of it dispersed and waded knee-deep through the snow into a birch forest to the right of the village, and immediately the sound of axes and swords, the crashing of branches, and merry voices could be heard from there. Another section, amid the regimental wagons and horses which were standing in a group, was busy getting out cauldrons and rye biscuit and feeding the horses. A third section, scattered through the village arranging quarters for the staff officers, carrying out the French corpses that were in the huts and dragging away boards, dry wood, and thatch from the roofs for the campfires, or wattle fences to serve for shelter. Some 15 men with merry shouts were shaking down the high wattle wall of a shed, the roof of which had already been removed. "Now then, all together, shove!" cried the voices, and the huge surface of the wall, sprinkled with snow and creaking with frost, was seen swaying in the gloom of the night. The lower stakes cracked more and more, and at last the wall fell, and with it the men who had been pushing it. Loud, coarse laughter and joyous shouts ensued. "Now then, catch hold in twos. Hand up the lever. That's it. Where are you shoving to? Now, all together. Wait a moment, boys. With a song." All stood silent, and a soft, pleasant, velvety voice began to sing. At the end of the third verse, as the last note died away, 20 voices roared out at once, "Whoa! That's it, all together. Heave away, boys." But despite their united efforts, the wattle hardly moved, and in the silence that followed, the heavy breathing of the men was audible. "Here, you of the 6th company, devils that you are, lend a hand, will you? You may want us one of these days." Some 20 men of the 6th company who were on their way into the village joined the haulers, and the wattle wall, which was about 35 feet long and 7 feet high, moved forward along the village street, swaying, pressing upon and cutting the shoulders of the gasping men. "Get along. Falling? What are you stopping for? There now." Merry, senseless words of abuse flowed freely. "What are you up to?" suddenly came the authoritative voice of a sergeant major who came upon the men who were hauling their burden. "There are gentry here. The general himself is in that hut. And you foul-mouthed devils, you brutes, I'll give it to you," shouted he, hitting the first man who came in his way a swinging blow on the back. "Can't you make less noise?" The men became silent. The soldier who had been struck groaned and wiped his face, which had been scratched till it bled by his falling against the wattle. "There, how that devil hits out. He's made my face all bloody," said he in a frightened whisper when the sergeant major had passed on. "Don't you like it?" said a laughing voice. And moderating their tones, the men moved forward. When they were out of the village, they began talking again as loud as before, interlarding their talk with the same aimless expletives. In the hut which the men had passed, the chief officers had gathered and were in animated talk over their tea about the events of the day and the maneuvers suggested for tomorrow. It was proposed to make a flank march to the left, cut off the vice-king, Murat, and capture him. By the time the soldiers had dragged the wattle fence to its place, the campfires were blazing on all sides, ready for cooking. The wood crackled, the snow was melting, and black shadows of soldiers flitted to and fro all over the occupied space where the snow had been trodden down. Axes and choppers were plied all around. Everything was done without any orders being given. Stores of wood were brought for the night. Shelters were rigged up for the officers. Cauldrons were being boiled, and muskets and accoutrements put in order. The wattle wall the men had brought was set up in a semicircle by the 8th company as a shelter from the north, propped up by musket rests, and a campfire was built before it. They beat the tattoo, called the roll, had supper, and settled down round the fires for the night, some repairing their footgear, some smoking pipes, and some stripping themselves naked to steam the lice out of their shirts. One would have thought that under the almost incredibly wretched conditions the Russian soldiers were in at that time, lacking warm boots and sheepskin coats, without a roof over their heads, in the snow with 18 degrees of frost, 8 degrees below 0 Fahrenheit, and without even full rations, the commissariat did not always keep up with the troops, they would have presented a very sad and depressing spectacle. On the contrary, the army had never, under the best material conditions, presented a more cheerful and animated aspect. This was because all who began to grow depressed or who lost strength were sifted out of the army day by day. All the physically or morally weak had long since been left behind, and only the flower of the army, physically and mentally, remained. More men collected behind the wattle fence of the 8th Company than anywhere else. Two sergeants major were sitting with them, and their campfire blazed brighter than the others. For leave to sit by their wattle, they demanded contributions of fuel.
"Hey, Makeyev, what's become of you, you son of a bitch? Are you lost or have the wolves eaten you? Fetch some more wood," shouted a red-haired and red-faced man, screwing up his eyes and blinking because of the smoke, but not moving back from the fire. "And you, Jackdaw, go and fetch some wood," said he to another soldier.
This red-haired man was neither a sergeant nor a corporal, but being robust, he ordered about those weaker than himself. The soldier they called Jackdaw, a thin little fellow with a sharp nose, rose obediently and was about to go, but at that instant there came into the light of the fire the slender, handsome figure of a young soldier carrying a load of wood.
"Bring it here, that's fine."
They split up the wood, pressed it down on the fire, blew at it with their mouths, and fanned it with the skirts of their greatcoats, making the flames hiss and crackle. The men drew nearer and lit their pipes. The handsome young soldier who had brought the wood, setting his arms akimbo, began stamping his cold feet rapidly and deftly on the spot where he stood.
"Mother, the dew is cold but clear. It's well that I'm a musketeer," he sang, pretending to hiccup after each syllable. "Look out, your soles will fly off," shouted the red-haired man, noticing that the sole of the dancer's boot was hanging loose. "What a fellow you are for dancing."
The dancer stopped, pulled off the loose piece of leather, and threw it on the fire.
"Right enough, friend," said he,
and having sat down, took out of his knapsack a scrap of blue French cloth and wrapped it round his foot.
"It's the steam that spoils them," he added, stretching out his feet toward the fire. "They'll soon be issuing us new ones. They say that when we finished hammering them, we're to receive double kits."
"And that son of a bitch Petrov has lagged behind after all, it seems," said one sergeant major.
"I've had an eye on him this long while," said the other.
"Well, he's a poor sort of soldier.
But in the 3rd Company they say 9 men were missing yesterday."
"Yes, it's all very well, but when a man's feet are frozen, how can he walk?"
"Eh, don't talk nonsense," said a sergeant major.
"Do you want to be doing the same?" said an old soldier, turning reproachfully to the man who had spoken of frozen feet.
"Well, you know,"
said the sharp-nosed man they called Jackdaw in a squeaky and unsteady voice, raising himself at the other side of the fire,
"a plump man gets thin, but for a thin one it's death. Take me now, I've got no strength left," he added, with sudden resolution turning to the sergeant major. "Tell them to send me to hospital. I'm aching all over. Anyway, I shan't be able to keep up."
That'll do," replied the sergeant major quietly.
The soldier said no more, and the talk went on.
"What a lot of those Frenchies were taken today. And the fact is that not one of them had what you might call real boots on," said a soldier, starting a new theme. "They were no more than make-believes."
"Well, the Cossacks have taken their boots. They were clearing the hut for the colonel and carried them out."
"It was pitiful to see them, boys," put in the dancer. "As they turned them over, one seemed still alive. And will you believe it? He jabbered something in their lingo."
"But they're a clean folk, lads," the first man went on. "He was white, as white as birch bark. And some of them are such fine fellows, you might think they were nobles."
"Well, what do you think? They make soldiers of all classes there."
"But they don't understand our talk at all," said the dancer with a puzzled smile. "I asked him whose subject he was, and he jabbered in his own way, a queer lot." "But it's strange, friends," continued the man who had wondered at their whiteness. "The peasants at Mozhaisk were saying that when they began burying the dead, where the battle was, you know, well, those dead had been lying there for nearly a month. And, says the peasant, they lie as white as paper, clean, and not as much smell as a puff of powder smoke.
Was it from the cold? Asked someone. You're a clever fellow. From the cold, indeed. Why, it was hot. If it had been from the cold, ours would not have rotted either. But, he says, go up to ours, and they're all rotten and maggoty. So, he says, we tie our faces up with kerchiefs and turn our heads away as we drag them off. We can hardly do it. But theirs, he says, are white as paper, and not so much smell as a whiff of gunpowder.
All were silent.
It must be from their food, said the sergeant major. They used to gobble the same food as the gentry.
No one contradicted him.
That peasant near Mozhaisk, where the battle was, said the men were all called up from 10 villages around, and they carted for 20 days and still didn't finish carting the dead away. And as for the wolves, he says,
that was a real battle, said an old soldier. It's the only one worth remembering. But since that, it's only been tormenting folk.
And do you know, Daddy, the day before yesterday we ran at them, and my word, they didn't let us get near before they just threw down their muskets and went on their knees. Pardon, they say. That's only one case. They say Platov took Polian himself twice, but he didn't know the right charm. He catches him and catches him, no good. He turns into a bird in his hands and flies away. There's no way of killing him either.
You're a first-class liar, Kisilyov, when I come to look at you.
Liar, indeed. It's the real truth.
If he fell into my hands, when I'd caught him, I'd bury him in the ground with an aspen stake to fix him down. What a lot of men he's ruined.
Well, anyhow, we're going to end it. You won't come here again,
remarked the old soldier, yawning. The conversation flagged, and the soldiers began settling down to sleep. Look at the stars. It's wonderful how they shine. You would think the women had spread out their linen, said one of the men, gazing with admiration at the Milky Way.
That's a sign of a good harvest next year.
We shall want some more wood.
You warm your back and your belly gets frozen. That's queer.
Oh, Lord.
What are you pushing for? The fire only for you? Look how he's sprawling.
In the silence that ensued, the snoring of those who had fallen asleep could be heard. Others turned over and warmed themselves, now and again exchanging a few words. From a campfire 100 paces off came a sound of general merry laughter.
Hark at them roaring there in the 5th company, said one of the soldiers. What a lot of them there are.
One of the men got up and went over to the 5th company.
They're having such fun, said he, coming back. 2 Frenchies have turned up. One's quite frozen, and the other's an awful swaggerer. He's singing songs.
Oh, I'll go across and have a look. And several of the men went over to the 5th company. The 5th company was bivouacking at the very edge of the forest. A huge campfire was blazing brightly in the midst of the snow, lighting up the branches of trees heavy with hoarfrost. About midnight they heard the sound of steps in the snow of the forest and the crackling of dry branches.
A bear, lads, said one of the men.
They all raised their heads to listen, and out of the forest into the bright firelight stepped 2 strangely clad human figures clinging to one another. These were 2 Frenchmen who had been hiding in the forest. They came up to the fire, hoarsely uttering something in a language our soldiers did not understand. One was taller than the other. He wore an officer's hat and seemed quite exhausted. On approaching the fire, he had been going to sit down, but fell. The other, a short, sturdy soldier with a shawl tied round his head, was stronger. He raised his companion and said something, pointing to his mouth. The soldiers surrounded the Frenchman, spread a greatcoat on the ground for the sick man, and brought some buckwheat porridge and vodka for both of them.
The exhausted French officer was Rambal, and the man with his head wrapped in the shawl was Morel, his orderly. When Morel had drunk some vodka and finished his bowl of porridge, he suddenly became unnaturally merry and chattered incessantly to the soldiers, who could not understand him. Rambal refused food, and, resting his head on his elbow, lay silent beside the campfire, looking at the Russian soldiers with red and vacant eyes. Occasionally he emitted a long-drawn groan, and then again became silent. Morel, pointing to his shoulders, tried to impress on the soldiers the fact that Rambal was an officer and ought to be warmed. A Russian officer had come up to the fire, sent to ask his colonel whether he would not take a French officer into his hut to warm him. And when the messenger returned and said that the colonel wished the officer to be brought to him, Rambal was told to go. He rose and tried to walk, but staggered and would have fallen had not a soldier standing by held him up. "You won't do it again, eh?" said one of the soldiers, winking and turning mockingly to Rambal. "Oh, you fool. Why talk rubbish, lout that you are? A real peasant," came rebukes from all sides addressed to the jesting soldier. They surrounded Rambal, lifted him on the crossed arms of two soldiers, and carried him to the hut. Rambal put his arms around their necks while they carried him and began wailing plaintively. "Oh, you fine fellows, my kind, kind friends, these are men. Oh, my brave, kind friends." And he leaned his head against the shoulder of one of the men like a child. Meanwhile, Morel was sitting in the best place by the fire, surrounded by the soldiers. Morel, a short, sturdy Frenchman with inflamed and streaming eyes, was wearing a woman's cloak and had a shawl tied woman fashion round his head over his cap. He was evidently tipsy and was singing a French song in a hoarse, broken voice, with an arm thrown round the nearest soldier. The soldiers simply held their sides as they watched him.
Now then, teach us how it goes. I'll soon pick it up. How is it?" said the man, a singer and a wag, whom Morel was embracing. "Vive Henri IV, vive ce roi vaillant, long live Henry IV, that valiant king," sang Morel, winking. "Ce diable à quatre, that rowdy devil."
"Vive Henri, vive ce rouvarou, ce diable à quatre,"
repeated the soldier, flourishing his arm and really catching the tune.
"Bravo! Ha, ha, ha!"
rose their rough, joyous laughter from all sides. Morel, wrinkling up his face, laughed too.
"Well, go on.
Dieu le triple talent de boire, de battre, et d'être un vert galant."
Who had a triple talent for drinking, for fighting, and for being a gallant old boy.
"It goes smoothly, too. Well, now, Zaletaev."
"Sure,"
Zaletaev brought out with effort.
"Dieu,"
he drawled, laboriously pursing his lips.
"Le triple talent de but de bas et de travagala,"
he sang.
"Fine, just like the Frenchie. Oh, ho, ho. You want some more to eat? Give him some porridge. It takes a long time to get filled up after starving."
They gave him some more porridge, and Morel, with a laugh, set to work on his third bowl. All the young soldiers smiled gaily as they watched him. The older men, who thought it undignified to amuse themselves with such nonsense, continued to lie at the opposite side of the fire. But one would occasionally raise himself on an elbow and glance at Morel with a smile.
"They are men, too," said one of them as he wrapped himself up in his coat. "Even wormwood grows on its own root." Oh, Lord, how starry it is. Tremendous. That means a hard frost.
They all grew silent. The stars, as if knowing that no one was looking at them, began to disport themselves in the dark sky, now flaring up, now vanishing, now trembling. They were busy whispering something gladsome and mysterious to one another. Chapter 4. The Crossing of the Beryozina. Vilna, the Emperor Alexander, Kutuzov, his failing health. The French army melted away at the uniform rate of a mathematical progression, and that crossing of the Beryozina, about which so much has been written, was only one intermediate stage in its destruction, and not at all the decisive episode of the campaign. If so much has been and still is written about the Berezina, on the French side this is only because at the broken bridge across that river, the calamities their army had been previously enduring were suddenly concentrated at one moment into a tragic spectacle that remained in every memory. And on the Russian side, merely because in Petersburg, far from the seat of war, a plan, again one of fools, had been devised to catch Napoleon in a strategic trap at the Berezina River. Everyone assured himself that all would happen according to plan, and therefore insisted that it was just the crossing of the Berezina that destroyed the French army. In reality, the results of the crossing were much less disastrous to the French in guns and men lost than Krasnoye had been, as the figures show. The sole importance of the crossing of the Berezina lies in the fact that it plainly and indubitably proved the fallacy of all the plans for cutting off the enemy's retreat, and the soundness of the only possible line of action, the one Kutuzov and the general mass of the army demanded, namely, simply to follow the enemy up. The French crowd fled at a continually increasing speed, and all its energy was directed to reaching its goal. It fled like a wounded animal, and it was impossible to block its path. This was shown not so much by the arrangements it made for crossing as by what took place at the bridges. When the bridges broke down, unarmed soldiers, people from Moscow, and women with children who were with the French transport, all, carried on by vis inertiae, the force of inertia, pressed forward into boats and into the ice-covered water and did not surrender. That impulse was reasonable. The condition of fugitives and of pursuers was equally bad. As long as they remained with their own people, each might hope for help from his fellows and the definite place he held among them. But those who surrendered, while remaining in the same pitiful plight, would be on a lower level to claim a share in the necessities of life. The French did not need to be informed of the fact that half the prisoners, with whom the Russians did not know what to do, perished of cold and hunger, despite their captors' desire to save them. They felt that it could not be otherwise. The most compassionate Russian commanders, those favorable to the French, and even the Frenchmen in the Russian service, could do nothing for the prisoners. The French perished from the conditions to which the Russian army was itself exposed. It was impossible to take bread and clothes from our hungry and indispensable soldiers to give to the French, who, though not harmful or hated or guilty, were simply unnecessary. Some Russians even did that, but they were exceptions. Certain destruction lay behind the French, but in front there was hope. Their ships had been burned. There was no salvation save in collective flight, and on that the whole strength of the French was concentrated. The farther they fled, the more wretched became the plight of the remnant, especially after the Berezina, on which, in consequence of the Petersburg plan, special hopes had been placed by the Russians, and the keener grew the passions of the Russian commanders, who blamed one another, and Kutuzov most of all. Anticipation that the failure of the Petersburg-Berezina plan would be attributed to Kutuzov led to dissatisfaction, contempt, and ridicule more and more strongly expressed. The ridicule and contempt were, of course, expressed in a respectful form, making it impossible for him to ask wherein he was to blame. They did not talk seriously to him. When reporting to him or asking for his sanction, they appeared to be fulfilling a regrettable formality. But they winked behind his back and tried to mislead him at every turn. Because they could not understand Kutuzov, all these Russian commanders assumed that it was useless to talk to the old man, that he would never grasp the profundity of their plans, that he would answer with his phrases, which they thought were mere phrases, about a golden bridge, about the impossibility of crossing the frontier with a crowd of tatterdemalions, and so forth. They had heard all that before. And all he said, that it was necessary to await provisions or that the men had no boots, was so simple, while what they proposed was so complicated and clever that it was evident that he was old and stupid and that they, though not in power, were commanders of genius. After the junction with the army of the brilliant admiral and Petersburg hero Wittgenstein, this mood and the gossip of the staff reached their maximum. Kutuzov saw this and merely sighed and shrugged his shoulders. Only once, after the affair of the Beryozina, did he get angry and write to Bennigsen, who reported separately to the Emperor, the following letter. On account of your spells of ill health, will your excellency please be so good as to set off for Kaluga on receipt of this, and there await further commands and appointments from his imperial majesty. But after Bennigsen's departure, the Grand Duke Tsarevich Konstantin Pavlovich joined the army. He had taken part in the beginning of the campaign, but had subsequently been removed from the army by Kutuzov. Now, having come to the army, he informed Kutuzov of the Emperor's displeasure at the poor success of our forces and the slowness of their advance. The Emperor intended to join the army personally in a few days' time. The old man, experienced in court as well as in military affairs, this same Kutuzov, who in August had been chosen commander-in-chief against the sovereign's wishes and who had removed the Grand Duke and heir apparent from the army, who on his own authority and contrary to the Emperor's will had decided on the abandonment of Moscow, now realized at once that his day was over, that his part was played, and that the power he was supposed to hold was no longer his. And he understood this not merely from the attitude of the court. He saw, on the one hand, that the military business in which he had played his part was ended, and felt that his mission was accomplished. And at the same time, he began to be conscious of the physical weariness of his aged body and of the necessity of physical rest. On the 29th of November, Kutuzov entered Vilna, his dear Vilna, as he called it. Twice during his career, Kutuzov had been governor of Vilna. In that wealthy town, which had not been injured, he found old friends and associations, besides the comforts of life of which he had so long been deprived. And he suddenly turned from the cares of army and state, and, as far as the passions that seethed around him allowed, immersed himself in the quiet life to which he had formerly been accustomed, as if all that was taking place, and all that had still to be done in the realm of history, did not concern him at all. Chichagov, one of the most zealous cutters-off and breakers-up, who had first wanted to effect a diversion in Greece and then in Warsaw, but never wished to go where he was sent, Chichagov, noted for the boldness with which he spoke to the Emperor, and who considered Kutuzov to be under an obligation to him because when he was sent to make peace with Turkey in 1811 independently of Kutuzov and found that peace had already been concluded, he admitted to the Emperor that the merit of securing that peace was really Kutuzov's. This Chichagov was the first to meet Kutuzov at the castle where the latter was to stay. In undressed naval uniform, with a dirk and holding his cap under his arm, he handed Kutuzov a garrison report and the keys of the town. The contemptuously respectful attitude of the younger men to the old man and his dotage was expressed in the highest degree by the behavior of Chichagov, who knew of the accusations that were being directed against Kutuzov. When speaking to Chichagov, Kutuzov incidentally mentioned that the vehicles packed with china that had been captured from him at Borisov had been recovered and would be restored to him. "You mean to imply that I have nothing to eat out of? On the contrary, I can supply you with everything, even if you want to give dinner parties," warmly replied Chichagov, who tried by every word he spoke to prove his own rectitude, and therefore imagined Kutuzov to be animated by the same desire. Kutuzov, shrugging his shoulders, replied with his subtle, penetrating smile, "I meant merely to say what I said." Contrary to the Emperor's wish, Kutuzov detained the greater part of the army at Vilna. Those about him said that he became extraordinarily slack and physically feeble during his stay in that town. He attended to army affairs reluctantly, left everything to his generals, and while awaiting the Emperor's arrival, led a dissipated life. Having left Petersburg on the 7th of December with his suite, Count Tolstoy, Prince Volkonsky, Arakcheyev, and others, the Emperor reached Vilna on the 11th, and in his traveling sleigh drove straight to the castle. In spite of the severe frost, some 100 generals and staff officers in full parade uniforms stood in front of the castle, as well as a guard of honor of the Semyonov regiment. A courier who galloped to the castle in advance, in a troika with three foam-flecked horses, shouted, "Coming!" And Konovnitsyn rushed into the vestibule to inform Kutuzov, who was waiting in the hall porter's little lodge. A minute later, the old man's large, stout figure in full dress uniform, his chest covered with orders and a scarf drawn round his stomach, waddled out into the porch. He put on his hat with its peaks to the sides, and, holding his gloves in his hand, and walking with an effort sideways down the steps to the level of the street, took in his hand the report he had prepared for the emperor. There was running to and fro and whispering. Another troika flew furiously up, and then all eyes were turned on an approaching sleigh in which the figures of the emperor and Volkonsky could already be described. From the habit of 50 years, all this had a physically agitating effect on the old general. He carefully and hastily felt himself all over, readjusted his hat, and, pulling himself together, drew himself up, and at the very moment when the emperor, having alighted from his sleigh, lifted his eyes to him, handed him the report, and began speaking in his smooth, ingratiating voice. The emperor, with a rapid glance, scanned Kutuzov from head to foot, frowned for an instant, but, immediately mastering himself, went up to the old man, extended his arms, and embraced him. And this embrace, too, owing to a long-standing impression related to his innermost feelings, had its usual effect on Kutuzov, and he gave a sob. The emperor greeted the officers and the Semyonov guard, and again pressing the old man's hand, went with him into the castle. When alone with the field marshal, the emperor expressed his dissatisfaction at the slowness of the pursuit and at the mistakes made at Krasnoye and the Beryozina, and informed him of his intentions for a future campaign abroad. Kutuzov made no rejoinder or remark. The same submissive, expressionless look with which he had listened to the emperor's commands on the field of Austerlitz 7 years before settled on his face now. When Kutuzov came out of the study, and with lowered head was crossing the ballroom with his heavy, waddling gait, he was arrested by someone's voice saying, "Your Serene Highness." Kutuzov raised his head and looked for a long while into the eyes of Count Tolstoy, who stood before him holding a silver salver on which lay a small object. Kutuzov seemed not to understand what was expected of him. Suddenly he seemed to remember. A scarcely perceptible smile flashed across his puffy face, and bowing low and respectfully, he took the object that lay on the salver. It was the Order of St. George of the First Class. Note, the Order of St. George was founded by Catherine the Great in 1769 for distinguished exploits in war. The First Class, a very high honor, seldom given, is a star and cross attached to a ribbon. Next day, the field marshal gave a dinner and ball which the emperor honored by his presence. Kutuzov had received the Order of St. George of the First Class, and the emperor showed him the highest honors, but everyone knew of the imperial dissatisfaction with him. The proprieties were observed, and the emperor was the first to set that example, but everybody understood that the old man was blameworthy and good for nothing. When Kutuzov, conforming to a custom of Catherine's day, ordered the standards that had been captured to be lowered at the emperor's feet on his entering the ballroom, the emperor made a wry face and muttered something in which some people caught the words, "the old comedian." The emperor's displeasure with Kutuzov was specially increased at Vilna by the fact that Kutuzov evidently could not or would not understand the importance of the coming campaign. When on the following morning the emperor said to the officers assembled about him, "You have not only saved Russia, you have saved Europe," they all understood that the war was not ended. Kutuzov alone would not see this, and openly expressed his opinion that no fresh war could improve the position or add to the glory of Russia, but could only spoil and lower the glorious position that Russia had gained. He tried to prove to the emperor the impossibility of levying fresh troops, spoke of the hardships already endured by the people, of the possibility of failure, and so forth. This being the field marshal's frame of mind, he was naturally regarded as merely a hindrance and obstacle to the impending war. To avoid unpleasant encounters with the old man, the natural method was to do what had been done with him at Austerlitz and with Barclay at the beginning of the Russian campaign, to transfer the authority to the emperor himself, thus cutting the ground from under the commander-in-chief's feet without upsetting the old man by informing him of the change. With this object, his staff was gradually reconstructed and its real strength removed and transferred to the emperor. Tol, Konovnitsyn, and Yermolov received fresh appointments. Everyone spoke loudly of the field marshal's great weakness and failing health. His health had to be bad for his place to be taken away and given to another. And, in fact, his health was poor. So naturally, simply, and gradually, just as he had come from Turkey to the treasury in Petersburg to recruit the militia and then to the army when he was needed there, now, when his part was played out, Kutuzov's place was taken by a new and necessary performer. The War of 1812, besides its national significance dear to every Russian heart, was now to assume another, a European significance. The movement of peoples from west to east was to be succeeded by a movement of peoples from east to west, and for this fresh war another leader was necessary, having qualities and views differing from Kutuzov's and animated by different motives. Alexander I was as necessary for the movement of the peoples from east to west and for the refixing of national frontiers as Kutuzov had been for the salvation and glory of Russia. Kutuzov did not understand what Europe, the balance of power, or Napoleon meant. He could not understand it. For the representative of the Russian people, after the enemy had been destroyed and Russia had been liberated and raised to the summit of her glory, there was nothing left to do as a Russian. Nothing remained for the representative of the national war but to die. And Kutuzov died. Chapter 5. Pierre, illness and recovery at Oryol. His new attitude to life and his fellow men. His affairs. He goes to Moscow. The town's animation and rapid recovery. Pierre meets Natasha at Princess Mary's. Love. As generally happens, Pierre did not feel the full effects of the physical privation and strain he had suffered as prisoner until after they were over. After his liberation, he reached Oryol, and on the third day there, when preparing to go to Kiev, he fell ill and was laid up for 3 months. He had what the doctors termed bilious fever. But despite the fact that the doctors treated him, bled him, and gave him medicines to drink, he recovered. Scarcely any impression was left on Pierre's mind by all that had happened to him from the time of his rescue till his illness. He remembered only the dull gray weather, now rainy and now snowy, internal physical distress, and pains in his feet and side. He remembered a general impression of the misfortunes and sufferings of people, and of being worried by the curiosity of officers and generals who questioned him. He also remembered his difficulty in procuring a conveyance and horses. And above all, he remembered his incapacity to think and feel all that time. On the day of his rescue, he had seen the body of Petya Rostov. That same day he had learned that Prince Andrew, after surviving the Battle of Borodino for more than a month, had recently died in the Rostov's house at Yaroslavl. And Denisov, who told him this news, also mentioned Hélène's death, supposing that Pierre had heard of it long before. All this, at the time, seemed merely strange to Pierre. He felt he could not grasp its significance. Just then he was only anxious to get away as quickly as possible from places where people were killing one another, to some peaceful refuge where he could recover himself, rest, and think over all the strange new facts he had learned. But on reaching Oryol, he immediately fell ill. When he came to himself after his illness, he saw in attendance on him two of his servants, Terenty and Vaska, who had come from Moscow, and also his cousin, the eldest princess, who had been living on his estate at Yelets and hearing of his rescue and illness, had come to look after him. It was only gradually during his convalescence that Pierre lost the impressions he had become accustomed to during the last few months, and got used to the idea that no one would oblige him to go anywhere tomorrow, that no one would deprive him of his warm bed, and that he would be sure to get his dinner, tea, and supper. But for a long time in his dreams, he still saw himself in the conditions of captivity. In the same way, little by little, he came to understand the news he had been told after his rescue, about the death of Prince Andrew, the death of his wife, and the destruction of the French. A joyous feeling of freedom, that complete inalienable freedom natural to man which he had first experienced at the first halt outside Moscow, filled Pierre's soul during his convalescence. He was surprised to find that this inner freedom, which was independent of external conditions, now had, as it were, an additional setting of external liberty. He was alone in a strange town, without acquaintances. No one demanded anything of him or sent him anywhere. He had all he wanted. The thought of his wife, which had been a continual torment to him, was no longer there, since she was no more. "Oh, how good, how splendid," said he to himself, when a cleanly laid table was moved up to him with savory beef tea, or when he lay down for the night on a soft, clean bed, or when he remembered that the French had gone and that his wife was no more. Oh, how good, how splendid. And by old habit, he asked himself the question, "Well, and what then? What am I going to do?" And he immediately gave himself the answer, "Well, I shall live." Ah, how splendid! The very question that had formerly tormented him, the thing he had continually sought to find, the aim of life, no longer existed for him now. That search for the aim of life had not merely disappeared temporarily. He felt that it no longer existed for him and could not present itself again. And this very absence of an aim gave him the complete, joyous sense of freedom which constituted his happiness at this time. He could not see an aim, for he now had faith. Not faith in any kind of rule or words or ideas, but faith in an ever-living, ever-manifest God. Formerly, he had sought him in aims he set himself. That search for an aim had been simply a search for God. And suddenly, in his captivity, he had learned, not by words or reasoning, but by direct feeling, what his nurse had told him long ago, that God is here and everywhere. In his captivity, he had learned that in Karatayev, God was greater, more infinite and unfathomable than in the architect of the universe recognized by the Freemasons. He felt like a man who, after straining his eyes to see into the far distance, finds what he sought at his very feet. All his life he had looked over the heads of the men around him when he should have merely looked in front of him without straining his eyes. In the past, he had never been able to find that great, inscrutable, infinite something. He had only felt that it must exist somewhere and had looked for it. In everything near and comprehensible, he had seen only what was limited, petty, commonplace, and senseless. He had equipped himself with a mental telescope and looked into remote space, where petty worldliness hiding itself in misty distance had seemed to him great and infinite merely because it was not clearly seen. And such had European life, politics, Freemasonry, philosophy and philanthropy seemed to him. But even then, at moments of weakness, as he had accounted them, his mind had penetrated to those distances, and he had there seen the same pettiness, worldliness, and senselessness. Now, however, he had learned to see the great, eternal, and infinite in everything, and therefore, to see it and enjoy its contemplation, He naturally threw away the telescope through which he had till now gazed over men's heads, and gladly regarded the ever-changing, eternally great, unfathomable, and infinite life around him. And the closer he looked, the more tranquil and happy he became. That dreadful question, what for, which had formerly destroyed all his mental edifices, no longer existed for him. To that question, what for, a simple answer was now always ready in his soul. Because there is a God, that God without whose will not one hair falls from a man's head. In external ways, Pierre had hardly changed at all. In appearance, he was just what he used to be. As before, he was absent-minded and seemed occupied not with what was before his eyes, but with something special of his own. The difference between his former and present self was that formerly, when he did not grasp what lay before him or was said to him, he had puckered his forehead painfully, as if vainly seeking to distinguish something at a distance. At present, he still forgot what was said to him, and still did not see what was before his eyes, but he now looked with a scarcely perceptible and seemingly ironic smile at what was before him, and listened to what was said, though evidently seeing and hearing something quite different. Formerly, he had appeared to be a kind-hearted but unhappy man, and so people had been inclined to avoid him. Now, a smile at the joy of life always played round his lips, and sympathy for others shone in his eyes with a questioning look as to whether they were as contented as he was, and people felt pleased by his presence. Previously, he had talked a great deal, grew excited when he talked, and seldom listened. Now he was seldom carried away in conversation, and knew how to listen, so that people readily told him their most intimate secrets. The princess, who had never liked Pierre, and had been particularly hostile to him since she had felt herself under obligations to him after the old count's death, now, after staying a short time in Oriol, where she had come intending to show Pierre that in spite of his ingratitude she considered it her duty to nurse him, felt to her surprise and vexation that she had become fond of him. Pierre did not in any way seek her approval. He merely studied her with interest. Formerly, she had felt that he regarded her with indifference and irony, and so had shrunk into herself as she did with others, and had shown him only the combative side of her nature. But now he seemed to be trying to understand the most intimate places of her heart, and mistrustfully at first, but afterwards gratefully, she let him see the hidden, kindly sides of her character. The most cunning man could not have crept into her confidence more successfully, evoking memories of the best times of her youth and showing sympathy with him. Yet Pierre's cunning consisted simply in finding pleasure in drawing out the human qualities of the embittered, hard, and, in her own way, proud princess. Yes, he is a very, very kind man, when he is not under the influence of bad people, but of people such as myself, thought she. His servants, too, Terienti and Vaska, in their own way noticed the change that had taken place in Pierre. They considered that he had become much simpler. Terienti, when he had helped him undress and wished him good night, often lingered with his master's boots in his hands and clothes over his arm to see whether he would not start a talk. And Pierre, noticing that Terienti wanted a chat, generally kept him there. "Well, tell me, now how did you get food?" he would ask. And Terienti would begin talking of the destruction of Moscow and of the old count, and would stand for a long time holding the clothes and talking, or sometimes listening to Pierre's stories, and then would go out into the hall with a pleasant sense of intimacy with his master and affection for him. The doctor who attended Pierre and visited him every day, though he considered it his duty as a doctor to pose as a man whose every moment was of value to suffering humanity, would sit for hours with Pierre, telling him his favorite anecdotes and his observations on the characters of his patients in general, and especially of the ladies.
It's a pleasure to talk to a man like that. He is not like our provincials, he would say. There were several prisoners from the French army in Oriol, and the doctor brought one of them, a young Italian, to see Pierre. This officer began visiting Pierre, and the princess used to make fun of the tenderness the Italian expressed for him. The Italian seemed happy only when he could come to see Pierre, talk with him, tell him about his past, his life at home, and his love, and pour out to him his indignation against the French and especially against Napoleon. If all Russians are in the least like you, it is sacrilege to fight such a nation, he said to Pierre. You who have suffered so much from the French do not even feel animosity toward them. Pierre had evoked the passionate affection of the Italian merely by evoking the best side of his nature and taking a pleasure in so doing. During the last days of Pierre's stay in Oriol, his old Masonic acquaintance Count Villarski, who had introduced him to the lodge in 1807, came to see him. Villarski was married to a Russian heiress who had a large estate in Oriol province, and he occupied a temporary post in the commissariat department in that town. Hearing that Bezukhov was in Oriol, Villarski, though they had never been intimate, came to him with the professions of friendship and intimacy that people who meet in a desert generally express for one another. Villarski felt dull in Oriol, and was pleased to meet a man of his own circle, and, as he supposed, of similar interests. But to his surprise, Villarski soon noticed that Pierre had lagged much behind the times, and had sunk, as he expressed it to himself, into apathy and egotism. "You are letting yourself go, my dear fellow," he said. But for all that, Villarski found it pleasanter now than it had been formerly to be with Pierre, and came to see him every day. To Pierre, as he looked at and listened to Villarski, it seemed strange to him that he had been like that himself but a short time before. Villarski was a married man with a family, busy with his family affairs, his wife's affairs, and his official duties. He regarded all these occupations as hindrances to life, and considered that they were all contemptible because their aim was the welfare of himself and his family. Military, administrative, political, and Masonic interests continually absorbed his attention, and Pierre, without trying to change the other's views and without condemning him, but with the quiet, joyful, and amused smile now habitual to him, was interested in this strange, though very familiar, phenomenon. There was a new feature in Pierre's relations with Villarski, with the princess, with the doctor, and with all the people he now met, which gained for him the general goodwill. This was his acknowledgement of the impossibility of changing a man's convictions by words, and his recognition of the possibility of everyone thinking, feeling, and seeing things each from his own point of view. This legitimate peculiarity of each individual, which used to excite and irritate Pierre, now became a basis of the sympathy he felt for and the interest he took in other people. The difference, and sometimes complete contradiction, between men's opinions and their lives, and between one man and another, pleased him and drew from him an amused and gentle smile. In practical matters, Pierre unexpectedly felt within himself a center of gravity he had previously lacked. Formerly, all pecuniary questions, especially requests for money, to which as an extremely wealthy man he was very frequently exposed, produced in him a state of hopeless agitation and perplexity. To give or not to give, he had asked himself. I have it, and he needs it. Someone else needs it still more. Who needs it most? And perhaps they are both impostors. In the old days, he had been unable to find a way out of all these surmises, and had given to all who asked as long as he had anything to give. Formerly, he had been in a similar state of perplexity with regard to every question concerning his property, when one person advised one thing and another something else. Now, to his surprise, he found that he no longer felt either doubt or perplexity about these questions. There was now within him a judge who, by some rule unknown to him, decided what should or should not be done. He was as indifferent as heretofore to money matters, but now he felt certain of what ought and what ought not to be done. The first time he had recourse to this new judge
was when a French prisoner, a colonel, came to him and, after talking a great deal about his exploits, concluded by making what amounted to a demand that Pierre should give him 4,000 francs to send to his wife and children. Pierre refused without the least difficulty or effort, and was afterwards surprised how simple and easy had been what used to appear so insurmountably difficult. At the same time that he refused the colonel's demand, he made up his mind that he must have recourse to artifice when leaving Oriol to induce the Italian officer to accept some money, of which he was evidently in need. A further proof to Pierre of his own more settled outlook on practical matters was furnished by his decision with regard to his wife's debts and to the rebuilding of his houses in and near Moscow. His head steward came to him at Oriol, and Pierre reckoned up with him his diminished income. The burning of Moscow had cost him, according to the head steward's calculation, about 2 million rubles. To console Pierre for these losses, the head steward gave him an estimate showing that, despite these losses, his income would not be diminished, but would even be increased, if he refused to pay his wife's debts, which he was under no obligation to meet, and did not rebuild his Moscow house and the country house on his Moscow estate, which had cost him 80,000 rubles a year and brought in nothing. "Yes, of course, that's true," said Pierre with a smile. "I don't need all that at all. By being ruined, I've become much richer." But in January, Savelich came from Moscow and gave him an account of the state of things there and spoke of the estimate an architect had made of the cost of rebuilding the town and country houses, speaking of this as of a settled matter. About the same time, he received letters from Prince Vasily and other Petersburg acquaintances speaking of his wife's debts, and Pierre decided that the steward's proposals, which had so pleased him, were wrong, and that he must go to Petersburg and settle his wife's affairs, and must rebuild in Moscow. Why this was necessary, he did not know, but he knew for certain that it was necessary. His income would be reduced by 3/4, but he felt it must be done. Bielarski was going to Moscow, and they agreed to travel together. During the whole time of his convalescence in Oriol, Pierre had experienced a feeling of joy, freedom, and life. But when during his journey he found himself in the open world and saw hundreds of new faces, that feeling was intensified. Throughout his journey, he felt like a schoolboy on holiday. Everyone, the stagecoach driver, the post-house overseers, the peasants on the roads and in the villages, had a new significance for him. The presence and remarks of Bielarski, who continually deplored the ignorance and poverty of Russia and its backwardness compared with Europe, only heightened Pierre's pleasure. Where Bielarski saw deadness, Pierre saw an extraordinary strength and vitality, the strength which in that vast space amid the snows maintained the life of this original, peculiar, and unique people. He did not contradict Bielarski, and even seemed to agree with him, an apparent agreement being the simplest way to avoid discussions that could lead to nothing. And he smiled joyfully as he listened to him. It would be difficult to explain why and whither ants whose heap has been destroyed are hurrying. Some from the heap, dragging bits of rubbish, larvae, and corpses, others back to the heap, or why they jostle, overtake one another, and fight. And it would be equally difficult to explain what caused the Russians, after the departure of the French, to throng to the place that had formerly been Moscow. But when we watch the ants round their ruined heap, the tenacity, energy, and immense number of the delving insects prove that despite the destruction of the heap, something indestructible, which though intangible is the real strength of the colony, still exists. And similarly, though in Moscow in the month of October there was no government and no churches, shrines, riches, or houses, it was still the Moscow it had been in August. All was destroyed, except something intangible, yet powerful and indestructible. The motives of those who thronged from all sides to Moscow after it had been cleared of the enemy were most diverse and personal, and at first, for the most part, savage and brutal. One motive only they all had in common, a desire to get to the place that had been called Moscow to apply their activities there. Within a week, Moscow already had 15,000 inhabitants. In a fortnight, 25,000, and so on. By the autumn of 1813, the number, ever increasing and increasing, exceeded what it had been in 1812. The first Russians to enter Moscow were the Cossacks of Vintsingerode's detachment, peasants from the adjacent villages, and residents who had fled from Moscow and had been hiding in its vicinity. The Russians who entered Moscow, finding it plundered, plundered it in their turn. They continued what the French had begun. Trains of peasant carts came to Moscow to carry off to the villages what had been abandoned in the ruined houses and the streets. The Cossacks carried off what they could to their camps, and the householders seized all they could find in other houses and moved it to their own, pretending that it was their property. But the first plunderers were followed by a second and a third contingent, and with increasing numbers, plundering became more and more difficult and assumed more definite forms. The French found Moscow abandoned, but with all the organizations of regular life, with diverse branches of commerce and craftsmanship, with luxury and governmental and religious institutions. These forms were lifeless, but still existed. There were bazaars, shops, warehouses, market stalls, granaries, for the most part still stocked with goods, and there were factories and workshops, palaces and wealthy houses filled with luxuries, hospitals, prisons, government offices, churches and cathedrals. The longer the French remained, the more these forms of town life perished, until finally all were merged into one confused, lifeless scene of plunder. The more the plundering by the French continued, the more both the wealth of Moscow and the strength of its plunderers was destroyed. But plundering by the Russians, with which the reoccupation of the city began, had an opposite effect. The longer it continued, and the greater the number of people taking part in it, the more rapidly was the wealth of the city and its regular life restored. Besides the plunderers, very various people, some drawn by curiosity, some by official duty, some by self-interest, house owners, clergy, officials of all kinds, tradesmen, artisans, and peasants, streamed into Moscow as blood flows to the heart. Within a week, the peasants who came with empty carts to carry off plunder were stopped by the authorities and made to cart the corpses out of the town. Other peasants, having heard of their comrades' discomfiture, came to town bringing rye, oats, and hay, and beat down one another's prices to below what they had been in former days. Gangs of carpenters, hoping for high pay, arrived in Moscow every day, and on all sides logs were being hewn, new houses built, and old charred ones repaired. Tradesmen began trading in booths. Cookshops and taverns were opened in partially burned houses. The clergy resumed the services in many churches that had not been burned. Donors contributed church property that had been stolen. Government clerks set up their baize-covered tables and their pigeonholes of documents in small rooms. The higher authorities and the police organized the distribution of goods left behind by the French. The owners of houses in which much property had been left, brought there from other houses, complained of the injustice of taking everything to the faceted palace in the Kremlin. Others insisted that as the French had gathered things from different houses into this or that house, it would be unfair to allow its owner to keep all that was found there. They abused the police and bribed them, made out estimates at 10 times their value for government stores that had perished in the fire, and demanded relief. And Count Rostopchin wrote proclamations. At the end of January, Pierre went to Moscow and stayed in an annex of his house which had not been burned. He called on Count Rostopchin and on some acquaintances who were back in Moscow, and he intended to leave for Petersburg 2 days later. Everybody was celebrating the victory. Everything was bubbling with life in the ruined but reviving city. Everyone was pleased to see Pierre, everyone wished to meet him, and everyone questioned him about what he had seen. Pierre felt particularly well disposed toward them all. but was now instinctively on his guard for fear of binding himself in any way. To all questions put to him, whether important or quite trifling, such as where would he live, was he going to rebuild, when was he going to Petersburg, and would he mind taking a parcel for someone, he replied, yes, perhaps, or I think so, and so on. He had heard that the Rostovs were at Kostroma, but the thought of Natasha seldom occurred to him. If it did, it was only as a pleasant memory of the distant past. He felt himself not only free from social obligations, but also from that feeling which, it seemed to him, he had aroused in himself. On the third day after his arrival, he heard from the Drubetskoys that Princess Mary was in Moscow. The death, sufferings, and last days of Prince Andrew had often occupied Pierre's thoughts, and now recurred to him with fresh vividness. Having heard at dinner that Princess Mary was in Moscow and living in her house, which had not been burned, in Vozdvizhenka Street, he drove that same evening to see her. On his way to the house, Pierre kept thinking of Prince Andrew, of their friendship, of his various meetings with him, and especially of the last one at Borodino. Is it possible that he died in the bitter frame of mind he was then in? Is it possible that the meaning of life was not disclosed to him before he died, thought Pierre. He recalled Karatayev and his death, and involuntarily began to compare these two men, so different and yet so similar, in that they had both lived and both died, and in the love he felt for both of them. Pierre drove up to the house of the old prince in a most serious mood. The house had escaped the fire. It showed signs of damage, but its general aspect was unchanged. The old footman, who met Pierre with a stern face as if wishing to make the visitor feel that the absence of the old prince had not disturbed the order of things in the house, informed him that the princess had gone to her own apartments and that she received on Sundays. "Announce me. Perhaps she will see me," said Pierre. "Yes, sir," said the man. "Please step into the portrait gallery." A few minutes later, the footman returned with de Salles, who brought word from the princess that she would be very glad to see Pierre if he would excuse her want of ceremony and come upstairs to her apartment. In a rather low room lit by one candle sat the princess, and with her another person dressed in black. Pierre remembered that the princess always had lady companions, but who they were and what they were like he never knew or remembered. This must be one of her companions, he thought, glancing at the lady in the black dress. The princess rose quickly to meet him and held out her hand. "Yes," she said, looking at his altered face after he had kissed her hand. "So this is how we meet again. He often spoke of you, even at the very last," she went on, turning her eyes from Pierre to her companion with a shyness that surprised him for an instant. "I was so glad to hear of your safety. It was the first piece of good news we had received for a long time." Again the princess glanced round at her companion with even more uneasiness in her manner and was about to add something, but Pierre interrupted her. "Just imagine, I knew nothing about him," said he. "I thought he'd been killed. All I know, I heard at second hand from others. I only know that he fell in with the Rostovs. What a strange coincidence." Pierre spoke rapidly and with animation. He glanced once at the companion's face, saw her attentive and kindly gaze fixed on him, and, as often happens when one is talking, felt somehow that this companion in the black dress was a good, kind, excellent creature who would not hinder his conversing freely with Princess Mary. But when he mentioned the Rostovs, Princess Mary's face expressed still greater embarrassment. She again glanced rapidly from Pierre's face to that of the lady in the black dress and said, "Do you really not recognize her?" Pierre looked again at the companion's pale, delicate face with its black eyes and peculiar mouth, and something near to him, long forgotten and more than sweet, looked at him from those attentive eyes. "But no, it can't be," he thought. "This stern, thin, pale face that looks so much older, It cannot be she. It merely reminds me of her. But at that moment Princess Mary said, Natasha. And with difficulty, effort, and stress, like the opening of a door grown rusty on its hinges, a smile appeared on the face with the attentive eyes, and from that opening door came a breath of fragrance, which suffused Pierre with a happiness he had long forgotten, and of which he had not even been thinking, especially at that moment. It suffused him, seized him, and enveloped him completely. When she smiled, doubt was no longer possible. It was Natasha, and he loved her. At that moment, Pierre involuntarily betrayed to her, to Princess Mary, and above all to himself, a secret of which he himself had been unaware. He flushed joyfully, yet with painful distress. He tried to hide his agitation, but the more he tried to hide it, the more clearly, clearer than any words could have done, did he betray to himself, to her, and to Princess Mary, that he loved her. "No, it's only the unexpectedness of it," thought Pierre. But as soon as he tried to continue the conversation he had begun with Princess Mary, he again glanced at Natasha, and a still deeper flush suffused his face, and a still stronger agitation of mingled joy and fear seized his soul. He became confused in his speech, and stopped in the middle of what he was saying. Pierre had failed to notice Natasha, because he did not at all expect to see her there. But he had failed to recognize her, because the change in her, since he last saw her, was immense. She had grown thin and pale, but that was not what made her unrecognizable. She was unrecognizable at the moment he entered, because on that face, whose eyes had always shone with a suppressed smile of the joy of life, now, when he first entered and glanced at her, there was not the least shadow of a smile. Only her eyes were kindly attentive, and sadly interrogative.